Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Zen Center. It's a beautiful day. Spring is coming. I ordered my twins tickets yesterday. I'm pretty excited. And this morning I'd like to talk about the subject of dana. Dana is one of the most important Buddhist values. A good translation of the word dana, which is a Sanskrit word, also a Pali word, same word in both languages, is generosity. We're big on generosity. According to one definition, dana is the voluntary giving of material energy or wisdom to others. So you've probably, if you've been here before on a Sunday, you've heard the word dana, because at the end of our lecture on Sunday, we pass this red bowl here, which is called the dana bowl, the generosity bowl, the bowl in which you can put contributions for Zen Center. Dana is one of the six paramitas, which are also known as the six perfections of the bodhisattva. The others are discipline, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. Right now, some of you are in spring practice period, and you're talking about the six paramitas. So you are, or will soon be, very familiar with dana. So I'd like to begin talking about dana in the widest possible context, and then I'm going to talk about dana in a pretty narrow context, which is the context of giving money. According to one definition, dana is giving to others. So it refers to discrete acts of helping. But there's a sense in which I think we can think of dana as being something much wider than simply giving things to others, than simply transferring energy or wisdom or material goods from one person to another. We can think of it as something that we practice constantly. We can think of dana as something which is the very heart of our practice. We can give in each moment. There's a quote on your program, which some of you have, from Sharon Salzberg, and it reads, "If we practice giving over and over, it grows very strong. Externally, it frees others. Internally, we free ourselves. The movement of the heart in generosity mirrors the movement of the heart in letting go on the inner journey." I think that's very nice. And there's more. There's another line, which I think is not in the program, which says, "Letting go, abandoning, relinquishing is actually the same mind state as generosity." So she's kind of saying that the inner journey and this gesture which we have of giving something to another person kind of mirror each other, but she's also saying that it's really the same mind state. They're really the very same thing. And they are. They are the same mind state, because this practice we do is a very giving practice. It's a very giving practice, giving moment to moment. Sometimes we don't think about this as giving. We may think about this practice as accomplishing something. We may see this practice as something that gives us something, so that we'll be okay, so that we'll be better human beings, we'll be in better shape somehow. But that's not really the practice. The practice is giving every moment. I talked about bowing at my last Tuesday night gathering. My subject was, why do we bow? Because we don't do too much bowing on Sunday. Sometimes we'll bow to each other. We might bow when we enter the room or bow to our cushion. But if you were to come on a weekday morning when we're doing a service, you would see that we do a lot of bowing. And one thing bowing isn't, even if we're bowing here at the altar, we're not bowing to a god. We're not bowing to something supernatural which exists outside of ourselves and can come and help us. We're not doing that. There are many reasons we bow, but one reason we bow is because it expresses giving. And it is giving. The very act itself of bowing is giving. This is a very giving gesture. And when we do our services in the morning, we do an even more dramatic giving gesture, which is to do a full bow using our whole body, where we will touch our head to the floor and we raise our hands like this. And that is a very giving gesture. And what that is saying is, you hear what it's saying? Yeah. That's pretty cool. That what that's saying is this moment's not about us. This moment is not about what we expected, right? I was going to come through with a great line there, and what do I get? I get this little tune, you know? It's not about us. The universe is not about us. You think you're going to give a great talk and have a great line, and what do you get? You get this little joke. But what you're saying in that moment is this universe is not about me. This life is not about me trying to arrange everything to make it exactly the way it will be to make me happy. It's not about me imposing my will on things. I have to do that to some extent. I have to survive and I want to be happy. But the really deep happiness is about letting go of that and just letting the world be what it is. Just letting it come. Just letting it come up. Letting it be. That's a profoundly giving thing to do. That's giving up our idea of what we want from the world. And Zazen meditation is the same way. We have this choice moment to moment in Zazen. Every moment we can let our mind wander. We can engage in a series of thoughts. We can engage in fantasy. We can do all kinds of things like that. Or in that moment, we can come back to our breath. Or we can come back to just being. And if we do that, that's a profoundly giving thing to do. Giving to this moment, giving up what we want from the moment, and coming back and saying, here I am with my breath, or here I am just being, or what is this moment? I mean, the most profoundly giving thing is to sort of ask the question rather than trying to come up with an answer, just saying, what is this? What is this? What is this? Let it be what it is. Let it be what it is. Because our mind wants to so badly to indulge itself by latching on to something. Our ego wants so very badly to assert itself and build itself and keep itself puffed up. But moment to moment, we can give ourselves to what here, what is here. That's what Dogen was talking about when he said in the Genjo Koan that one approach is conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment, conveying oneself toward things. That's taking the self forward in hopes of getting beyond the self. That doesn't work. You can't use the self to get rid of the self. Instead, there is all things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment. That's taking the backward step. That's letting things come to you. That's erasing your preferences and saying, what is here right now? And in great openness, there is a complete giving up of the self, of needs, of desires, of judgments, of wanting things to be different, of any kind of goal. And it's just that. And it's not, oh, this is nice. This is really nice. It can't be that. It's just giving. It's just giving. And in a way, it's not even giving. Because if you say giving, that means there's someone to give and there's someone to receive. And there's this duality here. And I, Ted, am giving something. It's beyond that. There's no giver. There's no receiver. There's no difference between Ted and the rest of the universe. There's not even giving. Ultimately, the idea of giving can be an impediment to our practice. But we still need to talk about it. We still need to talk about it because we have to talk. We have to talk this stuff over. But small mind can understand giving. What small mind doesn't understand is small mind does not exist. Small mind is not ready to talk about that yet. So dana is giving to others, according to one dictionary definition from one of my Buddhist dictionaries. Does that mean there has to be someone there to receive it in order for it to be dana? I don't think so. I think that's kind of a narrow view. I don't think dana is restricted to those times when someone is present and they have a need. I don't like that division. That's kind of like saying I have my generosity practice and then I have the rest of my life too. And some parts of the day I engage in my generosity practice and I stopped my car and I gave $2 to someone who was by the side of the road who looked really cold. And I was kind to someone at work, and I cleaned the bathroom because I knew that would make my wife happy. But the rest of the day was all about me. That was my generosity, and then there was the rest of the day. But wouldn't it be delightful to think of the whole day as giving? even when you're driving, even when you're sitting alone on your cushion, even when you're closing your car door, any little thing you're doing, that is actually a giving moment. And it can be a giving moment because you're giving up what you need in that moment. You're giving up your desire. You're just closing the door. You're doing this for all beings, you know? And maybe in that moment all beings are affected. Maybe not. Maybe not. But that is going to make a change in you, and beings will be affected because you will be different and you will treat the people differently around you because you were giving in that moment. So that's the very wide view of dana. Dana is something we do every moment. But there are many aspects of dana. There are many ways to give. We want to think about these things on a practical level. And now I'd like to address one particular aspect of dana. And that's the aspect we're most familiar with, the idea of contributing financially, because we have the dana bowl. We hear about dana during our annual membership drive. We hear about how we really love to have members here at Zen Center, and if you like it here and are going to come back, keep coming back, we encourage you to be a member, and we encourage you to contribute dana. And this feels really edgy to me. This feels really kind of uncomfortable to address this in a Dharma talk. It feels like I'm sort of crossing a boundary of some kind. You know, it feels like, okay, we'll ask for money after the talk, and you know it's coming, and you'll sit through it, and you'll throw in a couple dollars. And you know you'll get a little speech at you know, membership drive time. And that's okay, because it's done and it's over with. It's like NPR's fundraising drive. It's just 1 week, you know. You can deal with it. But sometimes it seems like on Sundays we're here to talk about our spiritual practice, you know, and we don't want to think about money, and that shouldn't be part of a Dharma talk. And that's precisely why I want to address this issue. Because I have this rule. If it makes you uncomfortable, it's probably got something to teach you. It's probably fertile ground for practice. And we like to go to those difficult places. If you've been here a few times, you know we deal with difficult issues. It's not all sweetness and light. It's not all sweetness and life. Because sometimes, a couple of weeks ago, Marty here gave this beautiful talk about the inevitability of death. It was really beautiful. And I'm glad he gave it. I mean, that's just wonderful, because this is where we deal with the deep issues. We deal with the deep issues here. So certain things are inevitable. Death and taxes, they say, right? So we had death a couple of weeks ago. Now we have finances. I might mention taxes a little bit. So we deal with all the difficult things here. So there's this thought we can have. You know, we're here to deepen our spiritual practice, not to think about money. And I've had that thought myself many times. I've had that thought about what you might call Zen Center business. For years, I've been coming here for 19 years, and for years I resisted the idea of being on the board because I just didn't want to go there, because I know what boards are like. You have to deal with financial issues and all this difficult stuff, and I'm here to sit, right? I don't want to think about that stuff. But time went on, and eventually I got to be on the board, and I like it, and it's part of my practice. But I see kind of a disconnect if my attitude is, well, I have my spiritual practice, which I do here on the cushion, and then I have this other stuff dealing with finances and business and all that stuff, and that's outside of my spiritual practice. But, you know, nothing can be outside of our practice. Nothing really can be outside of our practice. So I'd like to explore why this issue makes us so uncomfortable, and I came up with two reasons. The first one is that it's really hard to be mindful about money. We have a mindfulness practice. If you're new, you probably haven't heard about mindfulness yet. Mindfulness is something you do when you're engaged in activities, and it has to do with paying complete, full attention to your activity, not in a thinking way. to be fully engaged with your activity. Maybe thoughts come up. It's kind of like Zazen. You let them go, you come back to the activity. That's fairly easy to do. Well, it's never easy to do, at least not in the beginning. But it's easier to do it if you're, say, washing the dishes. You don't have to think much. You know how to wash the dishes. You know what to do, and you can keep coming back. I'm just washing the dishes. It's easier if you're pulling weeds or if you're raking the lawn or something like that. But it's hard to do when you're paying your taxes or paying your bills, of course. This is intense left brain activity, right? You get caught up in that. Your left brain gets really busy, and it's just hard to stay present. But also, we've got all kinds of aversions and attachments around money, which I'll talk about in a minute. So we tend to think something like this. Okay, I'm going to suspend my Buddhist practice for a few minutes, and then I'm going to pay these bills. And then I will resume my practice after that. But, you know, actually, it is possible to be mindful while paying bills. It's possible to be mindful while doing taxes. It's possible to be mindful while engaging in left brain activity. It's just harder. It's a lot harder, but you can do it. You can do it. Another way that this discomfort with issues of finances and things has been expressed is in this book by Lewis Richmond, Work as a Spiritual Practice. We had this as a text in a practice period a few years back. And he deals with money quite a lot because it's about practice at work, another really challenging area. And he kind of talks about how time is turned into money, and that makes us uncomfortable. But he also says, the great spiritual traditions all seem to agree. Money and spirituality do not mix. There is something about money that seems to draw us away from ourselves, that clouds our vision. People will cheat for money. They will lie, steal, even kill, all for something that has little intrinsic value in itself, and is ultimately nothing more than an elaborate social agreement. And that's true, and I don't want to lose sight of that. There's a sense in which money really is the root of great evil. It makes people crazy. It does not make them mindful. It's dangerous territory. Which leads into the second reason why this topic makes us uncomfortable. Money, finances, that whole thing, produces very strong aversions and attachments. And I think oftentimes these attitudes toward money develop in families. Not always, but sometimes a whole family will kind of share an attitude, I think. And it's interesting how poverty can really produce either an aversion or an attachment. I think some families are really poor, and as a result, they become obsessed with money. They really, really want it. They think if they can just get these things they need so badly, that they will be happy, and they'll be respected, and everything will be okay. It kind of makes this gaping hole. It's like a hungry ghost mentality. I just got to have that. Other families are poor, and they develop an aversion to money. And I don't know why it works differently for different people. That's probably all I'm going to say about attachment to money. I have a feeling in this crowd, aversion may be a more sort of lively topic than attachment. Or maybe it's just me. I don't know. But here goes. A little bit about my own experience with this. My family didn't have much money at all. I grew up on a farm in North Dakota. As some of you know, I tend to talk about stuff like this. I mentioned during my Father's Day talk, that was quite a while ago now, but I told this story about my father and how he had an argument with his father when he was farming in Iowa, farming his father's land. And he had a big argument with his father about conservation methods, specifically about contour plowing. And there were other things involved. But this argument about conservation was huge, and it caused a break, and my father moved the whole family to North Dakota, where we would farm up there, instead of farming the family farm. And This was a really good decision, I think, and I'm really proud of him for that. But it resulted in us having very little money because we kind of had to start over. And so the money was tied up in the land, and there just wasn't money for nice things. Just didn't tend to get the things we wanted. Like, I wanted a new bike like all the other kids had, because there was this new kind of bike that kids had which had little wheels and a banana seat. It was brand new, and I wanted one of those. And my parents knew I wanted a new bike, and they brought me home this new bike. And, you know, bless their hearts, they probably looked for a year to find a new bike on sale they could afford for me. But it was a funny-looking bike. It kind of, remember Pee Wee Herman's bike? It was a little, not that extreme, but a little bit like that, you know. And I said, oh, thanks, I love it, you know, and I rode it, and I convinced myself it was pretty cool. But things like that tended to happen. We were the only family I knew that couldn't afford a telephone. We didn't have a phone. And the saddest thing I can remember, I think, excuse me, is my mom had these antiques. She loved antiques, and she had about four pieces that she really loved that she had refinished herself. She had a settee and a buffet and a couple of other things. And one year, things were really bad. I think, you know, the crops weren't good that year. And so she decided she had to sell a couple of her pieces, and she contacted an antique dealer who came out to her house. And the antique dealer, no doubt sensing how desperate my mom was, said, ooh, I really like those two, I'll take them, but I have to have those two also. You have to sell me all four. And she had to do it. And she had to sell all four of these pieces. And I knew it just broke her heart. But she was optimistic. She was incredibly optimistic. And most of the good stuff I have, I got from her. And her attitude was always, you know, we don't really need the things that money can buy. We just don't need that stuff. And we're just not going there, you know, which I think was a good attitude. It's kind of a protective attitude. If you know you don't need that stuff, you're not going to feel too bad when you don't get it. So that was an aversion to money, to caring about money. And I still have that to some extent. Part of me, you know, deep down says I don't need it, I don't want it, I don't want to think about it. I'm not going to be responsible about it. I'm just not going to do that stuff. And really, I've gotten past that because I'm a responsible adult now and people depend on me. But I know it's in there. You know, we kind of have these sort of deep, deep ingrained values, and I know it's in there. And I think my personal aversion to dealing with these matters is strengthened by something you might call a generational factor. Some of you people who are around my age are probably going to relate to what I'm about to talk about here. And so if you'll indulge me a little bit, the best way to explain this is to tell you a little bit about an exhibit my wife and I recently saw at the History Center in St. Paul. It was an exhibit called 1968. Did anybody here see that? Yeah, a few people saw that. It was really good, right? I mean, wasn't it pretty exciting? We went on the last day, so I'm sorry you won't be able to go, at least not in St. Paul. It may be moving on somewhere else. But I went to this exhibit, and I was a little afraid it was going to be superficial. And the first thing I saw was outside the exhibit, these kids were making hippie headbands, you know, and decorating them with little pictures of, like, VW buses and things like that. And I thought, oh, I hope this isn't about fashion. I hope it isn't just all about bell bottoms and things like that. But it really wasn't. It was really, it was about the culture of 1968, but it was really about the political events and things too. And it was exciting. But it made me feel really old. Because here's why. I go up to this one table and they have this little typewriter there. It's a Smith Corona. And I say to my wife, that's almost exactly like the typewriter I bought with my graduation money. I remember I got $70 for graduation, and I bought a typewriter, a manual typewriter. I took it off to college, and I was sitting there kind of thinking of my, you know, happy hours typing away and doing my little manuscripts and things. And then these little kids come up. They're maybe 10 or 11. They're kind of looking at it, and they realize they can touch it, and they kind of push the key, and they go, wow, look at that. You press that, and this little thing goes up there and hits it. They had never used a manual typewriter before. It was like an antique. And even worse than that, there was I guess it is an antique. Whoa. And then there was this other table where there was a volunteer sitting there, and she was teaching these kids how to use a dial telephone. I mean, a lot of us grew up with that, and they didn't know how to do it. And she goes, no, you can't. You got to dial it all the way till you hit the stop. Otherwise, you're not going to get the right number. And they're looking really confused, like this was something unearthed from ancient Rome or something. So, but it was quite an exhibit, and my wife, Kathy, said to me, you know, wow, I lived through that, but I didn't realize so many significant things happened in that one year. And it was a horrible year. It was a horrible year. The Vietnam War was raging then. There were the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. There was the Tet Offensive early in the year, Black Panthers, all of these revolutionary things going on. Really, the country was kind of going crazy, and no one knew where it was going to go. No one knew where it was going to go, and you just didn't kind of know whether society was going to survive. It felt like things were really caving in. Nixon got elected. It ended with the first trip to the moon. Just things happening fast. Of course, I was 14. I thought this was normal life. You know, I thought life was like this, but it wasn't. And I started thinking about, well, what was I doing in 1968? And I realized it was really a watershed year for me too, because I was 14, around 14 at that time. And just kind of, you know, when you're 14, you kind of really start thinking, and you kind of start becoming an adult around that age. And I remember in my math class, my teacher, who was, I think he was an officer in the Air Force Reserve or something, would show us films. This was math class, but he would show us films about the Vietnam War and about why we were fighting. And I watched those, and I agreed with all of that. But this big change happened in 1968, which was my father decided the war was not right. He turned against it. This is an unusual thing to do in North Dakota. And he convinced me. He convinced me. Then the next year we moved to Iowa when I was 15. I started growing my hair long. I got these little wireframe glasses, which, you know, now it's no big deal. But back then it was kind of a revolutionary thing to do. And I spoke out freely against the war and in favor of civil rights. And I was this new kid in this school, kind of coming from the outside and acting all crazy. That got a lot of attention. And at that time, if you lived in a small town in the Midwest and you turned against the war, that wasn't just a change of opinion. That was a change in who you were. That was a change in how people viewed you. And if you're younger and you did not live through that time, you cannot imagine how divided the country was at that time. And how people there was just a lot of hatred. One of the iconic images from the war is there were a lot of people demonstrating somewhere. I can't even remember what city, but a lot of people demonstrating, and they had signs demonstrating against the war, and they were mostly hippies, long hairs, you know. And these construction workers wearing their hard hats kind of invaded and just started beating them up. And That's kind of how it was. That's one of the images of just kind of this hatred. And things changed pretty rapidly after that. A few years later, some of those construction workers probably started growing their hair long because it became fashionable. And a few years later, some of those hippies, including myself, became construction workers and started wearing hard hats and had long hair under their hats. And it all got kind of mixed up, you know? But in the beginning, if you had hair, long hair, and you spoke out in things, there was just this really, really clear divide. And if you spoke out against the war in small towns like that, there were people who wanted to hurt you, seriously. It could be dangerous. And this still gets my heart pounding a little bit, because even though it was 40 years ago, that was pretty tough. I think the most difficult thing I ever did was get through high school. But I don't want to dwell on that. And I also want to point out that things I went through are nothing compared to people who actually went to the war. I mean, that was the real serious stuff. But my point is, because the country was so divided, you were either in or you were out. It seemed like that. It seemed like there was no middle ground. You're either kind of buying into the establishment, as we called it, or you are rejecting it. And if I had been more sophisticated then, when I was 14, 15, 16, I would have realized, as I realize now, that there is a middle ground, and there are arguments on both sides, and it's best to avoid the extremes on both sides. And you see those who disagree with you, and you know they're people just like you, and you respect their motives, and you put yourself in their place, and you understand them. And you even remain friends, even though you disagree about these things. But in that environment at my age, I don't think I was able to do that. And that divide, and here I'm bringing this back to the subject of my talk, finally, that divide, that feeling of having dropped out completely, I think extended to attitudes toward money. Money was part of the rotten system, and you didn't want anything to do with it. And there was this kind of ideal that you really didn't want any more money than you needed to get by day to day, because other things were more important. You know, being creative, relationships, social action, being a good person. You know, we just don't want all of that attachment to money. And in some circles, I think, even the idea of trying to get a good job for yourself, going to college, advancing your personal career, was considered kind of a sellout. But that, I think, that of course is going too far. You know, times were better back then economically. And I think you could have that attitude for a few years and not court disaster, because things would improve again. These days, I don't think people have that luxury. These days, people kind of have the feeling, young people, that we have really got this to get this together, or this could be a major problem. So times were different in that sense. So that was a pretty severe and unworkable definition of selling out. It really doesn't make any sense, but it had some appeal for me. It's one of those many times in my life where I took a sound moral principle, attachment to money is not good, and I took it way too far and got into trouble. And what I see now is, of course, if you're not responsible financially, if you don't take care of yourself, you end up becoming dependent on others. Somebody pays for everything. It's just not you. I remember Tim, our head teacher, talking about how in San Francisco in the very early days of the San Francisco Zen Center, maybe even before the center was founded, it never occurred to him and his friends to contribute financially to Suzuki's operation. And I can believe that. You know, they didn't want to be sullied by money, didn't want to think about it. It just didn't occur to them. So what happened? I suspect what happened was Suzuki's salary was being paid by his Japanese congregation. Somebody was paying, it wasn't those folks. So, of course, as Buddhist practitioners, we know that the thing to do is to take care of ourselves, take care of the people around us in a very mindful and a very kind manner. That's what we do, right? Because we want to promote joy, we want to end suffering. That is what life is about. And so that includes being financially responsible. And if you view it that way, you know that although money can be a source of trouble in many ways, that attachment to money, aversion to money, those are things that we need to watch out for. There's nothing inherently distasteful about financial matters. Nothing at all. It's just a means to make things work. It's a part of our practice that we should give proper attention to. So there doesn't need to be any disconnect between our Buddhist practice and things like looking after our own personal finances, looking after Zen Center's finances, and contributing money to Zen Center. We need to see those things as they are. Those are just taking care of things, the same as sweeping the floor is taking care of things, the same way ringing the bell as Doan is taking care of things, taking care of the grounds, teaching, all of that stuff. It's no more and no less than that. It's just taking care of things. It's no big deal. It's really no big deal. But it's part of the deal. And it's something to feel good about, not something to feel uncomfortable about. So a couple of things that brought this home to me in a nice way I'd like to tell you about. One is when I was active at a meditation center in Northfield for quite a few years, we had a guest teacher who would come once a month or every 2 months or so. And when he would come, we would always collect dana from the group, and we would give it to him. But something about the way we were giving it to him just wasn't working very well. And I can't remember exactly what we did, but I imagine we kind of gave it to him in a very uncomfortable way. We probably just said, oh, and by the way, we collected some money, and we want you to have it, and here it is. You know, we're kind of embarrassed about it. And he said, don't do it that way. Here's what you do. You take the money, you put it in the envelope, and you give it to the teacher with a bow. You know, it's just acknowledge it. Don't be embarrassed about it. And a similar thing was at the first Zen temple I went to in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My teacher there, when I became a member, so I filled out my membership form and I put it in an envelope along with my initial contribution, and I take it to her, and she says, put it on the altar. And I thought, well, that's nice. So I took it and I put it on the altar where there was a large Buddha. They have a really large altar there. And I placed it on the altar and I made a little bow. And I felt pretty good about that. And that kind of says, you know, being a member is kind of, it's a financial commitment, and it's saying I want to be officially part of this, and maybe I have a little aversion to things being official, but I'm going to do this thing. We kind of say, you know, this is part of the practice too. This is the heart of the practice, so we'll put it on the altar. And I think that's pretty cool. And if any of you here aren't members yet and are thinking of becoming members, I would invite you to bring your membership envelope and place it on the altar. And then you know what's going to happen. Somebody who was not at this talk is going to come along, and they're going to see that, and they're going to go, there's money on the altar. What's going on here? But that's okay. They can deal with it. And then I have a quote from Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He says, if given in the spirit of non-attachment, the material offering and the teaching offering have the same value. That's true, isn't it? If we make a financial donation and we're in the moment and we're free of attachment and aversion and we're just saying, hey, this is for you, I love what you do, this is from me to you, it's just pure. It's just pure giving. That's all. We can feel good about that. So I'd like to say straightforwardly, without embarrassment, that Zen Center depends on your contributions, that it's very, very careful with your money, and that it does really beautiful things with the money you contribute. And I encourage you to contribute. And if you have no funds to spare right now, which may be the case. I know times are really hard, and everyone is affected to some degree, and some people are affected really badly. And young people especially, I know it's so hard to get a job right now. And if you simply don't have anything, that's okay. Please don't ever stay away. Because I've heard people say, you know, I feel bad about coming because I can't give anything. Don't ever feel that way. You know, you can come up with something later when times improve. Or maybe you've got a dollar. If you only got a dollar, that's okay. And our administrative director, Kimberly, told me she is so moved when she sees people who she knows they don't have much money, they're really struggling to get by, and they give $5 or $10 when they have it, that's profoundly moving. So, Zen Center does beautiful things, and I would just like to expand on that a little bit. People often don't know everything that's available here. And I know when you come in, you might go to the website and you see all this stuff going on, and you read the bulletin board and you see everything that's going on, and you kind of don't really know how to navigate it, and you kind of don't know how to fit in. And but there are a couple of things that can really help. One is that one-on-one meetings with teachers are available. You can talk to me or any of the other teachers here. We have 11 priests here now. It was 10. Now Bonnie's here, which is great because I always smile when I see her. We have 11 teachers here. If you would like to have a meeting with a teacher, you simply ask. You can email the office or you can talk to a teacher. There's no charge for this. Talking to a teacher can be really helpful. They can help you to kind of navigate the center. You can talk about your personal practice. You can set up a plan for yourself if you want as to kind of how you're going to approach your practice. And also in Zen, the teacher-student relationship is really important because it's not about stuff you learn in a book. It's all about right now. It's always about what is right now, always. And a teacher can really help you with that. Another thing we have here, we haven't always been really good in communicating this, but support during difficult times. We all go through difficult times. And this is a place that you should understand is here for you during like transitional difficult times in your life. This place is here for you. If you're part of this community and you get sick or something or you have some great difficulty, tell us about it. Don't keep it a secret. We want to know. We want to be able to reach out to you. There are things we can do. There are various kinds of support. Just talking about it with someone can really help. And we have services. We do these various kinds of services. We do weddings. We do memorial services. We do services for people who are sick. These can be traditional or they can be kind of your making. You know, we always kind of work with people on what they want. We can do a special service for something you don't that is not traditional, to mark something that services are not normally done for. We can make something up. So Zen Center, actually, you know, Zen Center was founded 40 years ago. That this year is the anniversary. It's been here for 40 years. It was established by Katagiri Roshi, his wife Tomoe, a lot of other people who are still around. And these are people who could have devoted themselves to just about anything, but they chose to devote themselves to this building and this place and setting this up. And maybe they had this idea. I have no evidence for this at all. I'm probably just projecting. But maybe they had this idea that they were establishing something that would last about 500 years. And I'm thinking it will. Maybe not at this location. I don't know if this building is going to last 500 years. But Katagiri Zen here in the United States, Katagiri Zen, all those priests you ordained who went and founded their own centers in various places in the country, Katagiri Zen is definitely going to survive in this country for 500 years, maybe longer. And think of all the people who have been positively affected in those 40 years. It's a huge number of people. And I think what's really striking about this center, there is the growth in the past 10 years. Really, since Tim came, we've had this incredible growth. You know, we've got, it's great, we've got a completely full Zendo here. This is really a nice crowd. We've had great crowds lately. We probably have 20 to 25 more people upstairs at the intro. We have Tuesday night gathering and Saturday morning guided meditation and classes and practice periods, all this stuff going on. But what really excites me is the community, the sense of community we have here. Those of us who have been here a long time are really close. Some of the new people, you may feel a little outside, but please stick around, have coffee, get to know people. We have our family Sundays, things like that. We have people bringing their children to the Zendo. And we're there during the great turning points of people's lives. And I think this truly is a refuge. If you've ever been gone for a while and then you come back, you probably remember that feeling you had of, wow, this is really nice. This is really nice. There's something really, really warm about this. And I've seen how this practice can change people. I've seen really big changes. People come here for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes people come here during difficult times, and they really need some help. And this is a place where people can really find their inner quiet and deal with those, whatever is bothering them. And it's a very simple and very effective way of dealing with it, which is to sit on this cushion. You know, people, I think, people are driven to do extreme things sometimes. They might try to climb a very high mountain, or they might try to row across the Atlantic solo, or they might hike the Appalachian Trail or something like that. Why do they do these things? Why are people so driven to do these things? I think they want to be driven to their very edge and see what they can find there. And that's great. There are a lot of different ways to do that. And it can be really liberating to do that, really scary and really liberating. But here's the good news. You don't have to mount an expedition in order to do that. You can come right here and you can sit on this cushion. And I tell you, if you sit on this cushion for 7 days during Rohatsu, you are going to have adventures. You are going to have incredible adventures. It's the same. It's the same as climbing that mountain. And it's pretty extreme, and it's pretty crazy, and it's wonderful. And it is the way to kind of go deeply toward that thing, whatever it is, whatever it is. And I have this firm belief that the thing you fear the most can be the path to your liberation, real liberation. And this is a place you can do that. And I will stop there. Thank you so much for listening. And we have a couple minutes. If a couple of folks have questions or comments, I'd love to hear them. Yes.
I just want to point out to people that money is a way of transferring energy. And if you're transferring your energy from your work into money and then transferring the money energy to the Zen Center, that's great. But you can also, we always need your physical presence and your energy that way too. There's always a member of the community who's in charge of the maintenance of the building, for example. So we always, and rather than have that person have to do all the cleaning and all the maintenance, it's nice if there's someone who will spend the next 3 months coming in once a week and cleaning the bathroom. Or, you know, I've done that. I've been a teacher. I've made coffee. I've done all kinds of things. And you really feel like it's done up. You really feel like you're genuinely contributing. And it is an act of generosity because your time is worth something. And I think you can feel good about that, too. So that's another way that people can contribute to the system.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. That's a very good point. Rounds out the talk a little bit. Yes. Yes.
I also want to kind of piggyback on what you just said. I am on the board to get a healthy grocery store on the north side, the co-op.
Oh.
And recently, yesterday, we just did interviews for a position. And in the north side, people are very poor. And they don't have a lot of money to give. I mean, one of the women had 6 children, but she gave her time, and she gave it to her community, and she was doing all these wonderful, beautiful things, trying to get her community together and to empower them, and I think that that's what this is a really nice community, and so if you could just give your time, your energy, and I was really just inspired by the generosity of the people that we interviewed yesterday, trying to help the community.
Wonderful. Thank you.